who have little to no experience with Frisbee. Clinics would be coached by volunteer women players and assisted by girls from local high school teams. Again, that's Free Beginner Girls Ultimate Frisbee Clinics on Saturday, March 14th from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. and again in the evening from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. at Gabriel Park, Southwest 45th Avenue and Vermont Street in Portland. More information can be found at KBOO.fm at the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is hiring a data coordinator. Our data coordinator supports KBOO's fundraising activities by organizing donor information, tabulating contributions and campaign totals, and maintains KBOO's database. Experience working with Donor Perfect preferred. The deadline to apply is Tuesday, March 24th, 2020. For a full job description and more information on how to apply, see our website at kboo.fm/employment. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is the writer Lance Olson. Olson is the author or co-author of 15 novels, 4 short story collections, and 7 works of nonfiction. His short stories, essays, and reviews have appeared in hundreds of journals and anthologies, including Conjunctions, McSweeney's, Bomb, Best American Non-Required Reading, and Black Warrior Review. Olson's accolades include a Guggenheim, the Berlin Prize, a Pushcart Prize, and an NEA Fellowship. He teaches experimental narrative theory and practice at the University of Utah, where he directs the creative writing program, and he's the author of the anti-textbook Architectures of Possibility After Innovative Writing, in collaboration with Trevor Dodge. A graduate of the Iowa Writing Center, from 2002 to 2018, Olson was the chair of the board of directors at Fiction Collective 2, a publishing house for artistically adventurous, non-traditional fiction that has published past Between the Covers guests Brian Evanson, Lucy Corin, Lydia Yuknovich, and Amelia Gray, as well as Samuel Delaney, Noy Holland, and many others. Lance Olson is here today to talk about his latest novel out from DeZank Books entitled My Red Heaven. Carol Maso says of My Red Heaven, "Lance Olson locates his porous, alluring, heartbreaking, and haunted narrative in Berlin on a day in 1927. Poised at a moment of such hope and doom, it is a ravishing meditation on history, on time, on what it is to be alive." Diego Baez at Booklist says, "Olson employs a full suite of experimental techniques to tell the story, including newsreel headlines, screenplay excerpts, poetic verses, and ekphrastic reflections on unsettling scenes of bombed out and abandoned buildings. But the real draw is Olson's supple, exacting prose, which captures the energy of cutting-edge art movements amid impending political uncertainty. There's an eerie familiarity to the air of technological and social breakthroughs, with fallout or resolution just around the corner. Olson manages the best of both worlds, a historical novel remarkable for its verisimilitude, and a work of innovative fiction that never employs invention for its own sake." Finally, Melanie Ray Tone says, "The moment in which you awaken is on fire. You are alive or the other thing, falling to scorched earth or ascending to the rooftops of Berlin, a radiantly red heaven. You feel yourself besieged, swirling inside one startling sensibility and then another, deliriums of joy pierced by devastations of loss and sorrow. Sparked by the exuberant energy of his own multivalent perception, ignited by the brilliance of his wildly playful imagination and unfathomably expansive compassion, Lance Olson has translated My Red Heaven, Otto Freundlich's abstract cubist painting, into a novel full of dissonant shocks and thrilling confusions, a library of loss revealing the perilous ecstasies of life in Berlin between the wars. Layer by layer, he unpeels a palimpsest of paint, turning his fiercely attentive, unbounded love to every being in every moment, exposing infinite unknown dimensions delivering us to exhilaration and terror as we watch the future and the past irradiate our present moment. Welcome to Between the Covers, Lance Olson.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So My Red Heaven takes place on a single day in 1927 in Berlin. And given that it's this specific time and this specific place that serve as sort of the foundational connective tissue for the book, rather than a specific character or a specific consciousness, talk to us about why you set us between the wars in Europe and also why we are in Berlin. What compels you about both this time and this place?
To begin to answer the first part, I guess, is so I have a relationship with Berlin that's very, very close. I was over there for 1 year on something called a DAAD fellowship, another half year on at the American Academy in Berlin, and also travel over there now at least once a year for 4 or 5 weeks. And I grew really close to the history of Berlin, to the energy of Berlin. It's this incredible sort of artistic mecca, but also began to read about the history and what was going on between the war years. And what was haunting to me as we approached 2016 were the parallels, the rise of populism, the slow erosion of democracy, the upending of how a government works. And so I became increasingly interested in that part of Berlin. And also, I think Berlin itself became a kind, well, you know, I think of Berlin as the protagonist of the novel, really, and all the people are sort of part of that larger canvas of Berlin that was filled in between the wars with this cultural exuberance. So all of those and more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if we think of in both the 1920s Berlin and say the 2020s America, this sense that the norms have been cast aside. Anything is possible to the extreme on either end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
How does the rise of that happening now, how is that informing you when you're approaching the Berlin of then?
Not too long ago, actually, came across an article in the Wall Street Journal that was published in 1933, just after Hitler had become chancellor. And it talked about how calmly Berlin, the German capital, responded to this, because they felt that though Hitler was out of control, he would be surrounded by those who would keep the lid on. And in certain ways, it was a good thing that he had been elected so that he could enter into sort of the institutional tamping down, you know, impulses of the culture. And then that didn't work. And again, I'm intrigued by the same sorts of impulses going on now, where we have you know, a president who is out of control in so many ways. 42% of the population seems to embrace that, because I think in really deep ways, certain parts of every culture want a really strong daddy figure who gets things done and is in control. So I started seeing all these sorts of parallels and wanted to explore those in more depth. And what was amazing about Berlin in you know, June 10th, 1927, this day that I focus on, so many people that we think of as essential to the idea of modernism and intellectual and aesthetic freedom were either moving through Berlin, people like Heisenberg, or settled in Berlin, people like Vladimir Nabokov, enjoying this incredibly rich cultural environment where everything really was possible, right? All the fences really were down. And at the very same moment, this authoritarian regime was increasingly coming to power and would ultimately undo all of that. And so, you know, over those 1920s, there's this incredible sense of irony floating, this grim sort of understanding in retrospect of what was going to happen, and everybody being utterly oblivious to that.
And if we stay on Berlin as protagonist, much like Berlin in America, Berlin of then and America of today seem porous to each other in this project. You've talked about how Berlin is sort of open and porous to its own past, to its own history, the Berlin of today.
Mm-hmm.
So could you talk to us about what you find unique about the Berlin of today in relationship to the Berlin that of its past?
One of the things I have come to really admire about German culture, and if we put it next to American culture, it really comes out. German culture after the war made a project of asking how one comes to terms with one's past, right? And particularly the atrocities of one's past. How does one deal with that as a culture? And what Germany decided to do was to seriously never forget, but always remind us. So there's something called tripping stones that one runs across in Berlin all the time. They're little brass plaques that are set into the sidewalk in front of buildings. And so you'll just be walking down the street and you'll see this in a doorway. And each of these lists the family members that were taken out of the building, where they were shipped, and how they were murdered during the war. So it's that idea that the past is incredibly present, but also always being intensely and dynamically remembered. And then you think of the U.S. and you think of race relations, or you think of the Native American population and the atrocities that have been committed, the genocide that's been committed, and America just has this crazy sense of leaving, not even leaving it behind, but absolutely negating that it ever happened. And so one of the things I wanted to do in terms of the novel was to really meditate on how the past ghosts us all continuously, and what would it look like to begin to create a project to remember that sense of atrocity in a culture.
Even that small gesture of the tripping or the stumbling stone,
yeah.
If you could imagine that in the United States, like instead of Confederate statues, we had a tripping stone in front of a house where a Japanese family used to live before they were taken away to internment. Or maybe we had another tripping or stumbling stone in front of a black-owned business that was firebombed, or in a place of particular importance to a Native nation. And everywhere we walked, we would stumble and remember our country's complicity in something. I wonder what that would do.
Right, and just the way you're saying that, like imagine what the present would look like if it were infused with the atrocities that went on, you know, if not on every corner, nearly on every block in some way, shape, or form, right?
Yeah.
And I admire so much that German impulse to, you know, it's so one of the things that I'm really interested in at the largest level is how we, any culture, deals with its sense of history and how the past itself is a kind of problem. Because who's telling the past, how one tells the past, from what, you know, point of view the past is told, changes the very nature of that past, right? And there's a theorist who's named Linda Hutcheon, who has this idea of historiographic metafiction. And what she does is to go in and look at texts that understand that idea of the very act of trying to tell the past is a problem, right? And so part of what I was involved with when I was working on My Red Heaven was exactly that, too. Like, to what extent do you need to be absolutely accurate in one's manifestation of the past? Can one be accurate? What does that even mean when one retells, right? And that got me thinking about this whole larger question of how cultures tell and retell the past, and how we can disrupt those retellings, make ourselves conscious of the very act of telling as a kind of engagement with power dynamics of history. Yeah.
Well, before we leave Berlin as topic, or at least leave it briefly, There's this great line in My Red Heaven: if Berlin were a part of speech, it would be a transitive verb. And I just wanted to hear your thoughts on that line a little bit.
It is crazy. I first went to Berlin about, I think, 4 years after the wall came down. And it was really pretty grim in the East. There was still a lot of pollution, and everything felt very gray and sort of misty. However, what happened was, and this is indicative of Berlin, it's still one of the cheapest cities in Europe to live in. You know, it's so much less expensive to live in, say, than London or Paris. The result was that there was this flood of artists into the area. And indeed, even when the wall was up, there was this whole thing, people like David Bowie, for instance, going over Iggy Pop and so on, that they understood when they went into the west of Berlin that sort of the world could end any minute, and there was this tremendous sense of freeing up. So there is the result of that is that there's still this kind of artistic center there that is extraordinary for its vitality. Artists, yeah, as opposed to, say, Manhattan, where you can't, like, live there anymore. As an artist, here you can live, you can flourish, but also you can do just these crazy-ass projects, and there will be a built-in audience that will love that and come to that and enjoy that. That's very much what was going on in the 1920s. You know, people were always like, well, you know, you're really pretty crazy, so you should go to Berlin. Don't go to Paris. Don't go to London. Go to Berlin. That's where everything can happen. And there's a kind of beautiful... I think of fiction as a possibility space, right, where everything can and should be tried. And Berlin is a possibility space where everything is continuously being tried. And that's beautiful.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to the writer Lance Olson about his latest book, My Red Heaven, from DeZank Books. So considering Berlin as physical space and how that physical space is in relationship to time is one entryway into My Red Heaven. But I think the most obvious and immediate way the book assumes a certain architecture is in relationship to the abstract Cubist painting of the same name. The German-Jewish painter Otto Freundlich. But your books both share the same name, or your paint is paint. So we start with underpainting, much as a painter would begin with the paint that would eventually get painted over. And so we are not only moving through Berlin on a given day, but we're moving across a canvas and through the process of the painting coming into being. So talk to us about Otto's painting, also who he was and why this specific figure and this specific painter engaged you enough to organize a project around him in specific.
Otto Freundlich is not a well-known painter. He was an abstract cubist painter. And his one claim to fame in retrospect is that one of his pieces appeared on the cover of the Nazi Entartete Kunst, the degenerate art exhibition in Munich. And that's mostly how we remember him. He was also a utopian artist whose grand idea, though it never came to fruition, was to build a road that linked Berlin to Moscow and to line this road with sculptures. It was this beautiful project that was going to be his life work, and it was going to show how art could bring together such diverse cultures and such diverse visions. Alas, what actually happened was that he had moved to France, to Paris, to get away from the Nazis. And when the Nazis came into Paris, they rounded him up. They took him to a concentration camp, and he was murdered the day he arrived. I happened to just be passing through Paris, the Pompidou, rounded a corner and saw his painting, My Red Heaven, Mein Roter Himmel. And what was beautiful about it, the painting itself is interesting. It's a lovely painting to look at, but what's very cool about it is that it's made, so let me describe it. If you move from the top down, there are these sort of blocks of different shades of red at the top. In the middle, there are these blocks of different shades of green and blue. And then at the bottom, there are these blocks of different shades, different qualities of black and gray. Okay, so Otto's eye moved from the bottom of the painting up, from this hellish sort of black up to this sort of utopian sort of red. And what I saw in that painting was a kind of embodiment. The painting came out or was finished in 1933, was the embodiment of everything that was going on in Berlin. The energy, the vibrancy, but also this idea of incommensurate positions with respect to reality, each of which was both tenable and completely arbitrary in each of those squares or shapes that were different sizes and so on. And I thought to myself, and this is how I often come to a novel, is what would happen if that were translated onto the page? Like, what would that look like? So novels often come to me in a shape with some kind of general idea, and then I think, how does that work in a narrative? What will that do to a narrative? And so if you translate Otto Freundlich's painting on to the page, you get this incredible canvas of different voices speaking. And that's what I wanted to explore. And in part, I think I wanted My Red Heaven to be a kind of song, love song to modernism. And so that's really where the novel came from, was his painting. And then if you think about it, my book actually reads the painting backwards. So it starts from this very energetic, lively sort of vision of the reds and moves down toward the blacks, because in fact, in retrospect, we saw that in 1933 everything changed in Berlin.
Yeah. You've said the painting My Red Heaven gestures toward a collage aesthetic, and your book My Red Heaven, and much of your work, does that as well. So much so that there's a chapter dedicated to you in the book, Collage in 21st Century Literature in English, Art and Crisis. And I was reading about collage in that book. It was interesting to discover that while collage is widely regarded to be an invention of the painters Pablo Picasso and George Braque, it was the Berlin Dadaists who were the first to subject collage to a political end. And it feels like you're employing the collage aesthetic to a political end here as well, like the Berlin Dadaists. So I was hoping we could talk not about the politics of the story of My Red Heaven, but the politics of collage, or what are its philosophic and aesthetic underpinnings for you that you would choose it as the way to tell the story that you're telling in the interwar years in Berlin?
It's a great question. So for me, how to say this? So when we usually read a novel, when we read, say, a psychological realist novel, we fall through the language into the world of the novel, and we inhabit that world, and you know, the cliche is we lose ourselves in that world. But what a collage does is something else. What a collage does is to create various voices, none of which is privileged over any other voice. And in that space, we're continuously reminded that we're living in an aesthetic form, that we're reading a novel that's part of an aesthetic form, even as we're falling into this voice or this voice or this voice. So for me, form always suggests philosophy, right? And so the question to ask ourselves is what philosophy does a given form suggest? And what's so miraculous about the collage form, the thing that I'm always drawn to in the collage, is that it's a polyphonic form that refuses neutralize diverse voices. And from an aesthetic, but also from a very human sort of perspective, I love that idea of exploring a consciousness that's absolutely incommensurate with another consciousness, a voice that's absolutely incommensurate, and just letting them sort of bump against each other, sometimes pay no attention to each other, sometimes conflict with each other, sometimes harmonize with each other, just like a city. So collage is a beautiful form also to engage with cities, because cities are by nature collage. Cities are by nature polyphonic and conflicted. So that's what kind of drew me into to notions of collage, I think, in general in my work. And then, of course, in My Red Heaven, each of these little consciousnesses that are moving through Berlin on a particular day are part of this larger canvas, right? This larger collage canvas.
So you said earlier that this book is also a love letter to modernism. And I do think you signal by having a book set in one day, it immediately makes me feel like it could be in conversation with Joyce and Ulysses and with Mrs. Dalloway and Virginia Woolf. But talk to us about what you mean by modernism. What modernist aesthetics for you are being employed or you're doing an homage to in this book. So tell us a little bit more about why you said it in one day, perhaps in relationship to others. But I would say not even perhaps, because those books both take place in June, which I doubt is a coincidence. And they were both, as your book takes place in June, and they were both written within 5 years before the setting of My Red Heaven also.
I really cut my teeth on the modernists. So let me sort of digress into a little story and then cut back to what you had just asked. But I was a terrible student in high school. I had about a D-minus average going into 11th grade. And then I had a teacher, one of those magic teachers, whose name was Joyce Garvin, who did the English class. And I was the kid who sat in the back of the room by the window and sort of stared out most of the time. I have no idea what incredible mind and sensitivity she had, but she called me up after class one day and she said, "Clearly you're not interested in anything we're doing in class." And I said, "Clearly not." And she said, "Let me just give you this book. Read it, we'll get together out of class and we'll talk about it." And she handed me Kafka's Metamorphosis. Like, what was that about, right? I'm like this kid in what, you know, 15 or something like that. I open it up and, you know, the first line, "Gregor Samsa awoke from uneasy dreams one morning to find he'd been transformed into a gigantic vermin, cockroach," however you want to translate those terms. I immediately fell in love with German, and I immediately fell in love with Kafka, and little did I know, I immediately fell in love with modernism. And when I went to college, I continuously gravitated. I started majoring in journalism, and that didn't go well. And so I began to gravitate toward the modernists. And there was something about meeting these texts, and I think we all go through this at some way, shape, or form, where you get to a text that is really difficult, like Joyce's Ulysses or Faulkner's As They Lay Dying. And some of us get turned off by that. Like, we are invited into this field of play, and you either say, "I'm going to leave the field of play because I don't understand the rules," or you go, how does this work, right? And I was always the, how does this, like, why is this happening? Like, why did Faulkner get away with this? Well, Faulkner's a collage novel. Joyce's Ulysses is a collage novel. Mrs. Dalloway's a more complicated narrative form, and I don't think you can talk about it in any way as a collage in that way. It works in a different set of principles. But in each of those cases, I just felt like I was in the sort of zone of a kindred spirit, and I want to, but the one that was so much smarter than I was, and so I wanted to understand how it all worked. And again, I always go to forms, so these forms were incredibly fascinating. Their sense of voice and voices, right? Stephen Dedalus's voice being so incredibly different from Molly Bloom's voice, Addie Bundren's voice being so incredibly different from Vardaman's voice. That fascinated me too, that an author could encompass all of these perspectives in one work.
Well, thank you for being on the show today, Lance. It was really great conversation.
Thank you, David. Just a blast talking with you.
We're talking today to Lance Olson about his latest book from DeZank Books, My Red Heaven. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Words and Pictures with host S.W. Conser.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland City Council Position 2 Candidate Forum on Wednesday, March 18th from 6 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at Metropolitan Community Church in Portland. The Portland Metro's People's Coalition and Unite Oregon will ask candidates how they plan to support a vision of a more inclusive and nurturing community. Again, that's the Portland City Council Position 2 Candidate Forum on Wednesday, March 18th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at Metropolitan Community Church, 2828 Southeast Stevens Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today we are going to be talking all about the adventures of the film community here in Portland. Allison Hallett is with us. Hello, Allison.
Hi.
Allison is the Education and Community Engagement Director at the Hollywood Theater. Her latest project is Movie Madness University. It's a new classroom program at Portland's video rental hub, and it'll be unspooling, so to speak, in the new Miniplex screening room that's recently been unveiled. But first, we have a couple of local filmmakers whose debut feature is having its premiere. It had its premiere at the Portland International Film Festival. These two are co-directors of the coming-of-age film Thunderbolt